Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from Jupiter, Florida and Fort Lauderdale from the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM and WBOI 101.9 FM. One can hear the program live streaming. My guest this morning is the Reverend Father, Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miss Campbell, and our subject is the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War. As I say each week, the mission of the advocates to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Welcome, Father Miss Campbell, to the advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Very good to be with you, Richard. I'm delighted to join you and your audience.
Thank you. And, of course, we met not that long ago down at Florida Atlantic University when you met with one of the most interesting programs on Truman and the bomb with the noted historian McCulloch.
David McCulloch.
Excellent. That was a tremendous program. You know, Father Miss Campbell joined the permanent faculty at Notre Dame University in 1988. He chaired the history department from 1993 to 1998. And in addition to his responsibilities on the history faculty, served as rector and superior of the Morrow Seminary, the principal formation site for the Congregation of the Holy Cross in North America. His primary research interests are American foreign policy since World War II and the role of Catholics in the 20th century U.S. foreign relationships. His book, entitled George F. Kennan and the Making of American Foreign Policy, was published in 1992 by the Princeton University Press. He received the Harry S. Truman Book Award. His more recent books have dealt with the transition of the presidency from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Harry Truman, with his award-winning 2007 book, From Roosevelt to Truman, Potsdam, Hiroshima, and the Cold War, and more recently, the most controversial decision, Truman, the atomic bombs, and the defeat of Japan. You know, in April of 1945, at almost the end of the European phase of World War II, in fact, not long ago, almost 71 years ago, but to the date, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in Warm Springs, Georgia. He had been reelected to a record fourth term and was approximately 90 days into his final term when newly elected Vice President Harry S. Truman assumed office. You know, therefore, with that in mind, Father Miss Campbell, can you set the stage regarding the end of World War II, the death of FDR, and the problem Truman faced in dealing with the new realities in Europe after VE Day?
Yes, well, you can imagine that Truman faced a pretty challenging set of circumstances. Roosevelt, of course, as you noted, had been president for 12 years, had guided the United States through World War II to the sort of edge of victory, at least in Europe. But of course, a significant circumstance that Truman faced was the reality that there was still the war in the Pacific to be won. So there were all kinds of military challenges for him and his administration. But the realities that were coming really to the fore for him in Europe was wrapping up the war, the final defeat of Germany, and then looking towards what kind of settlement could be reached in Europe. And of course, he was involved, as Franklin Roosevelt had been, in a whole series of negotiations with his two principal allies, the Soviet Union and Great Britain. So Truman was thrown in at the proverbial deep end and began confronting all kinds of issues and questions. Some of which, of course, had arisen at the Yalta Conference. What would be the future of Poland? What would be the future of Germany? What would be the place of Europe in world affairs? So he had a very, very complex inheritance from FDR. Of course, that's the topic or subject of the book that I wrote in 2007, From Roosevelt to Truman. That book looks at the implications of the transition from FDR to Harry S. Truman, which, as you would know, Richard, has been the subject of such controversy, and a range of scholars have had all kinds of interpretations as to the meaning of that transition for American foreign policy, and I believe you might have even had some of them on your programs at various points. Folks like Susan Butler and Frank Castigliola have a quite different interpretation of that transition than I do.
Mm. Was Truman enough of an internationalist to deal with this?
One of the contributions that I think my own book makes was to show how Truman evolved in his thinking. Truman, of course, had fought in World War I, been a soldier over there in Europe, but then came back to the United States, you know, got married, began his pretty quickly his political career, and was heavily focused on domestic issues through the 1930s. But it's fascinating to note how Truman, in the midst of the war, begins thinking about a new international organization. As a senator, he begins campaigning for it. And one of the reasons that I think FDR eventually agreed to acquiesce in the political bosses sort of organizing for Truman to be his vice president in 1944 was that he realized that Truman would be of significant help for him in getting a peace treaty or a new international organization approved by the U.S. Senate, because people had a positive views of Truman in the Senate. He had been a very much a person who got along with other senators. So Truman had developed a strong internationalist commitment, and I think it's fair to say that he in no way wanted the United States to retreat back into any kind of post-war sort of isolationist or nationalist stance. He wanted the United States to engage the world. He thought the United States would be a crucial player in structuring a post-war peace. Mm. So in broad terms, he was very much an internationalist. Mm. What I don't think anyone could claim was that he was fully cognizant of all the issues that, you know, the details of them and so forth. He simply was not. He was not well briefed. He had not been sort of brought into FDR's inner circle
right.
and thinking during his time as vice president. But his broad instincts, yes, he wanted to engage the world. He recognized the shameful and disastrous consequences of appeasement diplomacy and neutrality in the 30s, and he wanted the United States to do something vastly different in the post-war period.
Yeah. You know, approximately 2 months after FDR's death, the new big three met in Potsdam, Germany, to decide both the political delineation of post-war Europe and the conclusion of the war in the Pacific. Father Miscampbell, what happened at Potsdam, and what was the impact of both Churchill's loss at the polls in Britain and Truman's learning of the successful atomic bomb testing in Alamogordo, New Mexico?
Yeah. Now, Potsdam, in some ways, is a conference that doesn't get perhaps the attention it deserves, although there's a good book out by Michael Nyberg on Potsdam that some of your listeners may be interested in. Truman and Churchill and Stalin met at Potsdam, but as you mentioned there, Churchill returned back to London to get the results of the British elections in the midst of the Potsdam conference. Much to his surprise, the British electorate turfed out the Conservatives and elected the Labour Party. So in the midst of an international conference, Britain changed its leadership, and Clement Attlee and his Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin, came back to Potsdam to wrap up the conference. Interestingly enough, I don't think there was a major change in British policy because of that transition. And most folks have accepted that Attlee and Bevin essentially continued on the approach that Churchill and his Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, had pursued. You would recall, Richard, there'd been a unity government in Britain during the World War II, so Attlee was well briefed. He'd been a member of Churchill's cabinet, etc., etc. So I don't think there's an enormous impact on Potsdam as a result of Churchill's loss in the elections. But let me just set a little more background. More important, I think, for policymaking at Potsdam was Truman's decision just in the month beforehand to appoint as Foreign Secretary James F. Burns, a figure who doesn't get a lot of attention, but I think a crucial player in the 1945-46 into 47 period. He's Truman's principal advisor during that time, and Burns arrives with a sort of negotiator's stance. He wants to get along with the Soviets, but he wants to reach practical settlements with them. And Burns and Truman essentially accept a sphere of influence peace at Potsdam. They recognize there's nothing they can do, really, about Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. Their hope is that the Soviets will go a little easy on the East Europeans. So Potsdam, though, is seen as an initial stage of wrapping up the war in Europe. And one of Truman's great desires when he arrived at Potsdam was to gain Stalin's confirmation that he would participate in the war in Japan, against Japan. And he got that confirmation from Stalin. And even when the news came of the successful atomic bomb testing at Alamogordo in New Mexico, there's not a major shift in American policy towards the Soviet Union. They still recognize, although Burns flirted a little with the idea of are the Soviets really as necessary as they we thought they were, General Marshall says to him, look, we need them to tie down the Japanese army in Manchuria. They've got to be involved, et cetera, et cetera. So Potsdam is what Truman and Burns think of as the initial stage. They think there are going to be further meetings, further summit meetings with the Soviet and British leaders. Of course, there never are. But it's an initial stage to wrap up the situation in Europe. They form the Council on Foreign Ministers, which is to negotiate peace treaties, etc., etc. They're trying to learn some of the lessons from the mistakes of the Versailles Conference. They don't want to hold one of these major conferences where there are, you know, tens and tens of countries represented. So Potsdam, an initial stage in which the Soviets confirm that they will enter the war against Japan. But Truman does certainly appreciate the news that the atomic bomb has been tested, and of course the authorization is given at Potsdam for the use of these weapons against Japanese targets. Of course, they only have two bombs, and they authorize the use of both against military industrial targets in Japan.
You know, before we go into our last question, basically before a break, maybe I'll have time for a couple more. Did Truman, as a poker player, feel that he had three aces in his hand that no one was aware of, certainly Stalin wasn't aware of, and because of the bomb? And do you think, sort of editorial, do you think he had an inward smile that these that this atomic bomb was a big advantage for the United States in any further dealings with the Soviets, which he distrusted, he seemed? Quick answer before our next question. What do you think? Do you think he really...
Truman less so. Burns hoped it would be of some diplomatic advantage in his dealings with the Soviets. It's interesting to me is how little they seek any diplomatic advantage, though, out of the use of the bomb. They certainly, Truman gives a veiled mention of it to Stalin at Potsdam. They don't try atomic diplomacy. My book, in my view, dismantled the old notion of atomic diplomacy that Garo Perovitz had put out so many years ago. I don't think that thesis holds up.
Right. You know, speaking of your book, The Most Controversial Decision, you wrote that both President Truman and James Byrne, his confidant, confidant and Secretary of State, felt it was a success of sorts. Later, you wrote that Burns, in his memoir, Speaking Frankly, said that Potsdam was the success that failed. Later, in 1957, he referred to a large number of agreements that were reached there, only to be broken as soon as the unconscionable Russian dictator returned to Moscow. Father Miss Campbell, what did he mean? What did he mean by that? And were all the agreements really broken by the Soviets?
Well, what Burns hoped for was what I call a sphere of influence peace, borrowing from the work of an excellent historian, Mark Trachtenberg. And Burns felt that he had made sizable concessions to the Soviets on reparations, on their more or less, having a kind of control over Eastern Europe. But Burns hoped that the Soviets would be sufficiently reassured that they wouldn't come in with a sort of totalitarian domination of Eastern Europe, that they would allow some limited domestic freedoms in places like Poland. So down the way, he saw that Stalin, as he established, you know, that awful control that he eventually did establish across Eastern Europe, was breaking his agreements there. And as Burns came to see it, the Soviets as well had ambitions beyond that sphere. And that's where he saw the breaking of agreements, particularly on Germany, where they had hoped for some sort of joint control. But he saw the Soviets doing what they wished in their own zones. And that's what pushed him to proceed ahead in 1946 to try and secure the western zones of Germany from Soviet influence. That's where Burns thought he'd reached a sort of a deal that could be a kind of compromise operation that would allow these two very different political economic systems to at least sort of coexist. And he saw that from his perspective, Soviet ambitions, that Stalin had a sort of voracious appetite to control more and more, and that's what eventually he and Truman had to organize to stand up against. It's in that willingness of the United States to resist Soviet expansionist tendencies that the Cold War gets joined.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and before we get to our first break, basically Roosevelt, more of the real politic politician who maybe understood and was going to rely on future diplomacy, and we'll get into that, made two prescient statements. One was he wasn't going to allow 5 million American Poles to start a third world war, and he, when asked after Yalta, and of course he said, I got the best deal I could get, you know, and maybe he did, noting that all these troops, of course, he didn't know about the atomic bomb, all these troops that the Russians had in Eastern Europe. Before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter and WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father and Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miss Campbell. We'll be back in a few seconds with our next segment. Welcome back. This is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM in Jupiter and, of course, WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father, Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miss Campbell, about the end of World War II, the Potsdam Conference, what happened in Europe in the immediate wake of the negotiations regarding the vacuum that was next to be filled by both the Western Allies, the United States and Britain, with France playing a small role in occupation, the Soviets in the eastern part of Europe. In our first segment, we're discussing the end of World War II, the Potsdam Conference, and some of the elements that led to Truman's dissatisfaction with the Soviets. You know, in my last interviews with Professor Frank Castigliola, author of FDR's Lost Alliances, and Susan Butler, author of Roosevelt and Stalin, the Partnership that won World War II, They seemed to believe that FDR had developed a special trust and relationship with Stalin, and Truman, who had little experience in world and wartime politics, was unprepared for the challenges and the fears of the Soviet Russia and their immediate needs. You brought up a bit of your understanding of Truman, because you really specialize on Truman. How did you analyze Truman, and did he overreact to the anti-Soviet advice he got from people, again, like Secretary Burns and Averell Harriman?
Look, I want to address a matter first up in light of your mentioning the work of Professor Frank Castiglione and Susan Butler and their books, because I know, Richard, of your own high regard for Franklin Roosevelt. I hold him in high regard for his leadership during the New Deal and guiding the United States to the edge of victory in World War II. But I would hold a quite different stance than Frank Castiglione and Susan Butler regarding FDR. They present FDR as having established some kind of trusting relationship with Stalin, and I find that interpretation just not sustained by the evidence and as revealing, dare I say, a terribly naive view of the Soviet Union. Stalin was not a person who had a trusting relationship with anyone, I don't think, in his entire life. And poor FDR, I think, was beginning to realize this in the final months of his own presidency as some of the issues and difficulties began crashing down upon him. He was deeply worn down by that point. But Truman arrives in office having this inheritance of a Franklin Roosevelt trying to cooperate with the Soviet Union. And I maintain that the broad sweep of American policy from April of 1945, when Truman takes office, April 12th, through to the Potsdam Conference, consisted of a genuine effort on his part to maintain this cooperative relationship with the Soviet Union. And while folks are always bringing up Averell Harriman's influence, the more influential person who was advising Truman was a known Sovietophile named Joseph Davies, who was former ambassador to Moscow.
Right.
Truman worked hard to be even-handed in his dealings with Churchill and with Stalin during that period. He didn't want to give any hint of Anglo-American collusion against the Soviets. Truman dispatched Harry Hopkins to Moscow, FDR's closest aide, to Moscow in May of 1945. He made concessions on Poland. He withdrew American troops from the assigned Soviet zone in Germany. All these things testify to his desire to have continuity with the policy of Franklin Roosevelt. So while there was some advice initially from Harriman for a sort of get tough approach, Truman tactically tried to do that in the initial weeks in office, but the broad approach is much more one of continuity. I encourage my readers, I encourage your listeners to be readers of my book, and I hope I can persuade them to that point. It's too easy for folks to simply say, oh, there was a sharp reversal in policy. If only the sainted FDR had lived, and not that, you know, Missouri Harry Truman come into office, all would have been well. That interpretation is not sustained by the evidence, and it ignores the reality of Stalin and Soviet intentions.
You know, you, and of course, you make interesting points, as you know, and I read your book and their book, and of course, it's not for me to come down, you know, on one side or the other, reflective of this conversation. You know, in your book, The Most Controversial Decision, you discussed in depth the monumental decision by Truman to drop the bomb in Japan. And, of course, he learned about it at Potsdam, and
Well, he learned about the work on the bomb beforehand, and
right.
I would contest slightly your characterization of it as a monumental decision. there was just a momentum already established that when the bombs were developed, they would be used against Japan. So,
I agree. But, you know, you and I discussed this at an earlier time, I believe. The question was the, and please address this, was the bomb dropped solely to end the war quickly when some of the critics, as you have mentioned and have stated before, said that this was also done to impress the Soviets?
Yes.
How about that argument? Does that hold any water, or was it just the that's a specious sidebar issue?
That case has certainly been pushed by a number of American historians, and of course it plays in well with those who want to assign responsibility for the origins of the Cold War to the United States. But I have done, significant research, wrestled as best I could with this question, and it is very clear to me, based on the evidence, that the primary motivation that Truman has is the military defeat of Japan. Now, I'm not suggesting that Truman, and as I mentioned before, more especially Burns, didn't hope that there would be perhaps some diplomatic benefit down the way from the American possession of the atomic bomb. So I'm not suggesting that there wasn't some hope. But in terms of motivation for the use of the bomb, Truman is appalled as he is reading the casualty statistics of Americans killed and injured in Iwo Jima and Okinawa. He refers to not wanting, quote, an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other, contemplating the likely casualty figures of an American invasion in late 45 and then on the Tokyo plain in 1946 just worried him greatly. And he was obviously persuaded by the American military that the bombs might have some shock value that would persuade the Japanese military, who essentially control the Japanese government, to surrender. It was a near-miss thing. The Japanese military, of course, still wanted to fight on, even after the two atomic bombs and even after the Soviet declaration of war on August the 8th, 1945. But the Emperor Hirohito's intervention forced them to acquiesce.
You know, it's
a surrender. I presented primarily as, for military reasons, the United States used those atomic weapons against targets that Truman believed to be essentially military industrial targets. Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
You know, I agree with you 100% on that, and I've written that, as you know, and
yes.
And it's interesting that the Japanese generals who visited Hiroshima found no crater and said, well, we can dig and go underground. So, that's how antediluvian and nutty they were. Quick question before we go to a break. We have a very short time. Do you think that Stalin's awareness, obviously he was aware of the developing bomb through his spies, whether it was Klaus Fuchs or others at Alamogordo, did that affect Soviet thinking on how the United States was going to really hold their cards? In other words, quickly in a minute, didn't that influence too Soviets' fears and anxiety over the West?
It's certainly clear that Stalin wanted increased emphasis placed on the Soviet atomic program. It's clear that they must have worried that after fighting in this gigantic struggle against Hitler, their capitalist foe would seem to have stolen a march on them and to have had this new weapon. But I don't see any particular change in Soviet foreign policy as a result of their knowledge that the United States had the atomic bomb. Stalin wanted to cement his control in Eastern Europe and to move beyond Eastern Europe and as in Iran, etc., etc., and never seemed overly perturbed by the fact that the U.S. had an atomic monopoly.
Well, you know, that's very, very interesting, of course. You know, before we hear a word from the sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father and Professor of History at Notre Dame, Wilson Miscampbell. Will be back after a word from our sponsors in a few seconds. Welcome back. This is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter and WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father and Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miscampbell, about the end of World War II, the Potsdam Conference, the development of the A-bomb, and the effect on both the American-Soviet mindset. You know, FDR had virtually promised a Marshall-style plan for the Soviets long before future Secretary of State George Marshall had envisioned it for Western Europe. Father Miscampbell, if FDR had lived, could his command of the world stage and the trust the Russians had in him change the post-war equation, or is this, as you said earlier, maybe fanciful to the reality of what Stalin's innate desires were about?
I do lean in the latter interpretation that you have just given, Richard, and my sense is that perhaps historians like Robert Dallek might be onto something when they suggest that FDR was fairly deft and might have moved fairly swiftly himself to alter the approach that he was taking to the Soviets once it became clear to him that Stalin was going to cement his control in Eastern Europe. But that's one of those what might have been questions that you cannot answer definitively. We can just work with what the situation was when FDR left office. And he left office leaving Truman a fairly sort of nebulous hope for cooperation with the Soviets. And I think one of the conclusions of my book that goes against folks like Frank Castiglione, Susan Butler, is that Truman continued trying to push this approach of conciliation and cooperation through 1946, when it's very interesting to note that a Labour government, a social democratic government in Great Britain, led by Clement Attlee and Ernest Bevin, were already starting to raise concerns about Soviet behavior and the extent of Soviet influence and their desire to extend that influence into not simply Eastern Europe, but Western Europe, where you would appreciate there were sizable communist parties in both France and Italy, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a good social democrat like Ernie Bevin trying to rouse interest in the United States to be stronger in their response to the Soviet Union. So that's a sort of reality that I think many American historians pass over. They're so focused on looking at America's relations with the Soviets, they neglect somewhat the British stance. But I think the British stance, and remember, as I say, this is a Labour government in Britain. These are people who are nationalizing the steel industry and so on, but they're good social democrats. They're democrats. And they see what's happening to good social democrats throughout Eastern Europe, and they're pretty worried. And they're pretty worried about the extent of Soviet ambitions. It's in those ambitions that I see the origins of the Cold War ultimately resting.
Yeah, I tend to agree. You know, it's a very nuanced point about this. You know, moving ahead to the end of World Pacific War with the dropping of the two A-bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the United States was in an unprecedented position of world strength, wealth, and hegemony. Were we overconfident with the regards to our future domination in world politics, and did we underestimate the fears of the Soviet Union and the desire to have a buffer of friendly socialist states to interact with? Well, you know, remember, that's sort of a side issue now. The isolation of communism, the anti-communist feeling that had been pervasive pre-World War II certainly led to the excesses of fascism in both Spain, France, and Germany, and even England. This fear of communism, did this lead to Stalin's paranoia, or was he just paranoid? that's the question.
Yeah, well, Stalin was paranoid. Interestingly enough, one of the few people that Stalin ever really trusted was Adolf Hitler.
That's
in
it.
The Nazi Soviet pact, it's a fascinating exercise to study Stalin's hopes. He hoped, of course, to turn Hitler westward, but it wasn't done just to secure the Soviet state, because he thought Hitler would eventually come at them. No, Stalin thought that he could do a deal with Hitler. I read not long back a book by, I think it was Roger Morehouse, The Devil's Alliance was the title. I know that. And leaders who want to understand what Stalin was really on about would do well to look at his behavior from 1939 to 1941. This is where I see FDR as somewhat naive in thinking that he could build a trusting relationship with Stalin. Anyone who had tracked Stalin's relationship with the Nazis would know that there was a deep animosity towards Western democracies that simply resided in Stalin, and the idea that there was some sort of easy settlement to be reached if only sufficient concessions were made to the Soviet Union is, I think, a completely naive, indeed a false idea. I think it was Bismarck who once observed, "No one will be ever rich enough to buy his enemies by concessions." And what I think is the critique that should be made of the Truman administration's early foreign policy is that it took them more time than it should have to realize the extent of Soviet ambitions, and it took them more time than it should have to gear up their response. So I have Burns felt he had already given the Soviets a buffer of friendly states. He essentially conceded Eastern Europe to them.
Right.
But it was when Soviet ambitions appeared to be going beyond that Soviet sphere that Truman and Burns roused up in their response. So you get the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, et cetera, in 1947.
Yeah, well, of course, and that's true. It's interesting, though, that the Soviet Union, with Stalin as the main guy, no matter what, did attempt to negotiate a non-aggression pact with both France and Britain before getting into the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, which sort of signaled that World War II would start. There's no doubt about that. And, of course, you're 100% correct about his designs on Greece and Turkey, and that's where the Truman Doctrine comes about. Of course, Italy was in the throes of social revolution to a degree in the wake of the fall of Mussolini and the fascists, and the Communist Party was very strong there, and France. It's a very interesting set of circumstances that always fill the vacuum of a great war. We saw that in World War I with the fall of the Hohenzollerns and the Habsburgs and the Romanovs and the Ottomans. And you know what? We're still dealing with that.
Absolutely. One of the.
I got to go to a break. We're going to catch this on the in our last segment. I have to go to a break, Father Miss Campbell. Before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP in Jupiter, WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father and Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miss Campbell. His very interesting books on Truman, post-war America and the Soviets. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back. This is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP in Jupiter and WOIB in Fort Lauderdale. I've been talking to my guest, the Reverend Father and Professor of History at Notre Dame University, Wilson Miss Campbell, about the end of World War II, the emerging distrust between the two remaining superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. You know, Father Miss Campbell, there was an obvious floundering between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. You've described it pretty accurately. We all of a certain age know it. Could you describe what happened and the conclusion that cooperation finally could not work? Where was the breaking point that you feel came about?
Yes, I think there are a number of sort of points that are sort of pushing the United States into a position where they think we've tried and we're not getting anywhere here. I'll jump ahead a little from some of what we've been discussing and go to 1947, the Moscow Conference. General George C. Marshall, you know, Army commander during World War II, has replaced James F. Burns as Secretary of State. And he is over in Moscow negotiating with the Soviets about a German settlement. So there are still negotiations going on between the two sides as late as March, April of 1947. And it dawns on Marshall that the Soviets are not really interested in a settlement in Germany, that they see advantage in economic and social chaos in Europe that they will then be able to take advantage of. Marshall then comes back to the United States, and that's the moment, it goes back to my first book on George Kennan, where he calls in the newly appointed director of the policy planning staff, George F. Kennan, and he says, we've got to do something about Western Europe. And therein, from that conversation, come all the discussions that lead eventually to the Marshall Plan, which, by the way, initially is held open to the Soviets to participate.
That's correct.
They, of course, refuse, because to participate in this joint plan, they're going to have to open up their system and society. And, of course, Stalin cannot bear that idea, would interfere with his own totalitarian control. So that is a key moment for me, when the West Europeans, with the support of the United States, begin this effort that clearly is aimed at distinguishing them from the Soviets. After that point, you get Bevin getting the Benelux countries and France together for the Brussels Pact, NATO comes afterwards, etc., etc. So, but that's a key moment. That first half of 1947 is a key moment in the American response to what they perceive as Soviet plans to dominate more and more of the Eurasian continent.
You know, and that leads back to some of the earlier points you brought up. The British had become junior partners in the Western Alliance to defeat Nazi Germany after the defeat of the Germans at the Battle of the Bulge, the crossing of the Rhine River, and for sure at the Yalta Conference. With this change of leadership, as you had mentioned, more the Labor Party, certainly Social Democrats, what was their role regards to the decline of the U.S.-Soviet relationship? Were they cheerleaders to this? And you seem to say that they were ahead of the curve on this.
Yes, this is a point not, I think, well appreciated or not appreciated enough by American the American public and American historians. Ernest Bevin is the person who picks up and pushes the Marshall Plan, but it's Bevin who was the initiator of NATO. It's not the United States. Bevin is trying to draw the United States into a commitment to West European defense. The Brits and the French both feel isolated and vulnerable in Western Europe against the presence of the Red Army throughout Eastern Europe, etc. It's not that they felt the Red Army was going to barrel across the North German plain and invade them, but they just felt that there was sort of political intimidation, etc., etc., from the Soviets. So Bevin and the British play an important role in the fashioning of the early Cold War, and they are seeking to engage the United States in these commitments to Western Europe. You'll recall FDR had thought that Europe should be reduced in its significance in world affairs and didn't expect the United States to be deeply involved in Western Europe after World War II. Here is the shifting paradigm from the Roosevelt approach to the Truman administration approach, which of course is the approach that the United States then pursued for all the years of the Cold War through its commitment to NATO, and to some extent, of course, it still continues that approach through its alliance with the various European states.
You know, we're coming to an end of this fascinating hour, and I really enjoy it. One last question before we have to come to a close. Could the Cold War have been avoided? And with that in mind, I think you mentioned this in one of your thoughts. Would the alternative leadership of either a Henry Wallace on the left or Robert A. Taft on the right made a difference? Or was Truman the right man in the right time to really recognize it, and sometimes you can't control all the events yourself?
Yes, it's I don't want to say that you know, an event couldn't have been avoided. What do they say? Death and taxes are
right,
the only things
two
that can't be avoided. But I would argue, Richard, that given Stalin's leadership of the Soviet Union, his paranoia and concern about outside threats, his desire to maintain such severe control within his own country, it's hard to see how some kind of Cold War could have been avoided with Stalin as the leader of the Soviet Union. So I know that that's not any sort of definitive, but that's the best that I can say. Now, let me take a look at both Henry Wallace, of course, a major figure on the left. He had been FDR's Secretary of Commerce. He'd been FDR's Vice President,
sure,
then Secretary of Commerce. Truman kept him on as Secretary of Commerce before firing him in 1946. Wallace goes off to lead the Progressive Party in the 1948 elections. Henry Wallace surely would have pushed for greater understanding of the Soviet position, for a more conciliatory approach, but I would say that he would have given the 1940s its own version of appeasement to rival the 1930s. Mercifully, it did not occur. He would have conceded far too much to the Soviet Union, and the United States would have been in a much more difficult situation. Robert Taft, of course, was the leader of the more unilateralist or isolationist wing of the Republican Party, and Taft didn't want to bail out Europe. He didn't want the Marshall Plan. He didn't want NATO. He didn't want the country to go in this internationalist direction. I see him as dangerous in some ways to the future of American foreign policy as Wallace. So from the right and the left, you have to remember, Truman is a person of the center left.
Right.
Truman wants universal health care. Truman's wanting full employment policies, etc. I'm always staggered that the revisionist criticism of Truman, mounted by folks who are on sort of the liberal left in contemporary intellectual circles, they mount this criticism of a person who was trying to push reform in the United States. I happen to believe the United States was very fortunate to have Harry Truman as its leader.
I got to agree with you, and I got to bring an end to this, unfortunately. I thank
Richard,
you.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
I thank you very much. Of course, I close, and it's been a great hour. If you want to hear this broadcast or any other archived Advocates broadcast, you can access on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where all the information, my guess, is always posted. Next week, I'll be back with Joe Bravo of the Office of the Disabled. We'll be discussing his role and the challenge he faces. Thank you again, Father Miss Campbell, for joining me. Be well.
Thank you, Richard.
Be well.
Bye now.